Well, very warm welcome, and wonderful that you've all come to hear about my time down in Australia. And hopefully, as I suggest there, it's a bit of an overview. I try and give you a flavour of the kind of things, the kind of issues, the kind of things that I got involved with in all aspects of the diocese there. And I got some pictures. I even got a little bit of video as well to show you some of the little excerpts that I've been able to capture, because in Aboriginal communities, one thing you always realize when you get there, they don't like you videoing and copying, photographing things, because some things are secret, some things are sacred, and no cameras allowed, no videos allowed. So whatever I've been able to capture, I've got a few little things. Let's begin with a prayer, because I think it's important, because we are actually sort of sharing in something of the church and its life in Australia. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you, Lord, for your generous love that you have revealed in Christ for all nations and all peoples and all places. Father, as we remember the work that I was able to do down in Australia, we pray for the people of the Northern Territory. And as we go through these slides and share the stories that I was able to enjoy and be a part of, we pray for those people, the Aboriginals, particularly in the Diocese of the Northern Territory, but all its work and mission. And we pray, Lord, that as we learn more about that part of our world, part of your church, we may keep them in our prayers and support them in all ways that we can, that your glory, your kingdom, your church may grow to your praise and glory in Christ. Amen. Right. Let's have the next slide. Oops. Let's see if it works. Right. A bit of geography, because it's always important to know where we're going to. You've got the Australia. We all know the whole big of Australia, the whole big shape of it. This is bang in the middle. This is South Australia here, there's Queensland, there's Western Australia, and this bit is called the Northern Territory. It's important to understand that a territory is not the same as a state. Something I had to learn out there is a different thing, different status, as it were, within the Commonwealth of Australia. They don't have the authority, the kind of power, the kind of, you know, that the states have. Darwin's right at the top left corner there. The yellow bits here that are coloured yellow are actually Aboriginal. Welcome, sir, welcome. We're going to have to get you. Is there another chair up there? There's a chair here for somebody. And are there any more chairs to be had somewhere? Have this one. Have that one. I mean, they're going to try and find some more upstairs. Or a bench. We've got a bench. Sorry, Sue. We squashed in here. So the yellow bits here, all the yellow bits are actually Aboriginal lands. They've actually been given by the state to the Aboriginal people to own, to have it as their land. And to travel into these areas, you need to have permits. They're not publicly accessible, because quite a few of them, like where I went to, this bit there, so you can see Arnhem Land, that yellow bit, that big square there, that's Arnhem Land. That's where I spent quite a bit of time. And a lot of those areas have restrictions, like, for instance, alcohol. They are dry areas. You can't bring alcohol into certain areas because of the issues that are related to, well, alcohol abuse and all that kind of thing. So basically, I was based in Darwin at the cathedral. I was given an office there. And the diocese is the entire Northern Territory. That's the diocese. The diocese is four times bigger than the United Kingdom in terms of land area. It is absolutely humongous. Catherine here, I'll be talking a bit about that, because that's the place there where we went to quite a bit. There were some conferences and various things I had to pop down. From Darwin to Catherine is a five-hour drive. That's basically the getting there. That's an idea. And here's Alice Springs, Tennant Creek. These are the main. And there's Ayers Rock. Uluru's over there. And it gives an idea of the scale of the diocese. It is absolutely huge. Everything is far away. And my drip, one thing you can see over here, Nukur is right on the Roper River over here. That's an eight-hour drive from Darwin to get there. And to give an idea of the perspective of just the distances, the roads, the kind of realities of life. So that's Northern Territory. Darwin is where I was based. And you can see that, in fact, there are lots of Aboriginal areas designated as such. And you come to know that more and more when you drive around there, where you can and cannot go. So the next slide, then. The big question is, well, why go to this place? Why go to Arnhem Land? Start with a scripture here from Matthew 28. Go and make disciples in all the world. As many of you know, I grew up in Cape Town in Africa. And growing up in part of the old empire, the Commonwealth, what it is today, has a huge impact. The church, where the empire went, the church went. Welcome, Florence. Welcome. Florence, did you come and join us today? I'll do my best speaking slowly, Florence. But the key question, of course, in my head has always been from very young. Where the British Empire went, the Church of England went. The Book of Common Prayer went. And I grew up in Cape Town in a church, it was a fairly high church. Book of Common Prayer was everything. That was it. There was nothing else. And if you were a black person growing up in Africa, you got the Book of Common Prayer translated into Xhosa or Zulu or Tswana, one of those languages. You got an Anglo-Saxon package of worship, basically. That's how you do it in Africa. And it's moving slowly away from that now. The challenge, as I got there, of cross cultures with the good news. How do you bring the good news to a people that just do not see the world as you see it, as we see, as Anglo-Saxon people? We are all shaped by our culture here in Western Europe. We see the world in a particular way. We're quite scientific, we're critical, we have all those faculties from our education that make us the people we are. So we see the world with very particular spectacles. In Africa, where I grew up, people had a difficulty as an African Xhosa person, like Nelson Mandela was a Xhosa, as I would say it. He saw the world differently, but of course he was shaped by a foreign kind of culture. His faith and his experience of his identity in life didn't really connect with an Anglo-Saxon package, the Book of Common Prayer, with how they experienced life and faith. They've moved a long way in Africa by indigenizing or Africanizing their faith, making it more authentically African, and disconnecting. There have been some real challenges in some of the cathedrals, for instance, where they decided, well, that kind of English choral tradition, what does it speak to us of our overlords, the people who came and were the colonialists who effectively took over our lives and dispossessed us in some respects? When I went to my last sabbatical, if you remember, in 2006, I went to New Zealand to do a very similar thing, worked with the Maori church, looking at a similar kind of issue. They were developing their prayer book, their very first prayer book, that actually was going to be rooted in their experience of being a Maori. Now, some of you have been to New Zealand, I'm sure. They'll tell you that if you go to the marae, where they meet, the tribes meet, they actually look at the world like, for instance, the rivers, the forests, the foreshore, the geography has significance, real significance for them, for their identity, their spirituality, and their tribal identity. These things are really important to them. And they've been brought back into that book of their new prayer book. And some have acclaimed it as being a very good prayer book because it does actually bring in that those elements of their culture and identity. But I can remember when I was out there, there were some people in the church in New Zealand who did not like it one bit, who thought it was in error, doctrinally in error, because, well, for some more evangelical people, these things are more important. But I have to say, the church has always evolved over the centuries, really, taking local traditions, making it Christian, taking it in and making it something that's going to be very useful for the mission of the church. So this whole cross-cultural challenge has always been with the church. And going to Arnhem Land and spending time in the diocese there, one of my key ideas was to spend time with them to see just how an Aboriginal person would be understanding their Christian faith and how that might be evolving. But in Australia, uniquely different from New Zealand or even Africa, New Zealand had the Treaty of Waitangi. In 1840, the young Queen Victoria, just fresh on the throne, signed a treaty with the Maori people, which said, the land is yours, not ours. And there was a legal relationship between the crown and the tribes. But that never happened in Australia. Okay, let's go to the next slide. And here we go. We know who that man is. That's Captain Cook. And of course, Captain Cook, when he came to Australia, they use a phrase called terra nullius. Some of you might know what that means. There's nobody here. They put the flag up and said, Australia is now claimed for the crown. And that by saying that there was nobody here, they just ignored the fact that there were people there. And literally from the times of Captain Cook till 1968, not long ago, the Aboriginal people did not have citizenship. Did you know that? They had no status in the Commonwealth of Australia. It's very odd. But they had a kind of strange first peoples, they were called themselves, but they didn't have a status or a standing. And to this very day, they don't have a proper formalized status within the Commonwealth, separate, say, from the people who arrived later on. Of course, as we know, the Aboriginal people, you'll see the pictures of this. We saw quite a few traditional things happening when I was in Arnhem Land, which once again, we weren't allowed to video or photograph because we weren't allowed to do it. But they've been there for 50,000 years. And their traditions have evolved over those 50,000 years. And of course, are deeply rooted in who they are and their identity. I'll be talking more about this as we go along, about what just happened to their identity and what it really says about the mission of the church, say, in one part of Australia, because there are Aboriginal people in Western Australia, Queensland, everywhere else, just focusing on Northern Territory today. So, Cook came along. They called them the pastoralists. And these are the people who came from the UK, essentially, on boatloads of people who wanted to have a new beginning. And, of course, they were encouraged to move because the British wanted their people, white British people, in all of their colonies for security, to take it and to make it British. And of course, the pastoralists arrived. And straight away, there was an issue about, well, what status does an Aboriginal man have living in his part of Australia? A hunter-gatherer, in effect, who doesn't have bits of ground that belong to them or very, you know, kind of not defined. But of course, pastoralists with the crown just moved north and they went. And they came, of course, right up to Arnhem Land, Alice Springs, and they claimed huge chunks of land. Inevitably, there were going to be clashes between the local Aboriginal people who were very hospitable initially, but eventually clashes happened and massacres happened. Now, I've read a lot of books on what happened. Shameful things were done in the 1800s. I mean, people, communities, literally, women, children were wiped out, literally killed without a second thought. People believed in those days that Aboriginal people were somehow not like us, subhuman, sort of. There were even debates in the church. Did an Aboriginal man have a soul? Can you believe it? But that's what was being discussed in some corners of the church. Others were saying absolute nonsense, they're just like us. Others are saying, well, because could you charge someone for murder if they killed an Aboriginal man or woman or whatever? And there was a question mark. And there were some horrendous travesties of justice, which have been put right. Some of them have come up even recently to make it clear that mistakes, not mistakes, terrible things were done in those days and putting it right. So the pastoralists and the missions, because where the empire went, the Church of England went, the Book of Common Prayer went, and the missionaries went, and the London Mission Society, CMS, they all were there doing their thing, and the Roman Catholics too, the Lutherans too, everyone was out there staking out their piece of Australia. And the irony is, to this very day, in Darwin, in the Northern Territory, the whole place is divided up to the different Christian traditions. So where I went to, Arnhem Land, is Anglican. The northern bits of it, that belongs to the Uniting Church, which is a Methodist church and a few others. The Roman Catholics over here, the Lutherans over there, and you don't cross the border because they're doing their mission over there. And it's really bizarre, but that is a kind of legacy of the missions. But one really important point to make at this very early stages is that the missions were vitally important to the Aboriginal people, because when they were being persecuted and slaughtered, and they really were slaughtered in their thousands by different people, the mission stations were the only place where they had refuge and protection. And they would go there to survive, literally to survive the ravages of some of the pastoralists. And you've seen some films, there've been a lot of films about just how Aboriginals have lived over this, you know, last 200 years. And really the missions were a vital part of their survival. And they really played a really important part in that. Because I'll be talking about this later as well. There's a big issue in Australia to this day about the culture of Aboriginal people, which is very much an itinerant culture, not a settled kind of culture that we have, and how they try to kind of bring that Western culture, which is very much a sedentary one, communities, organization in a particular way, with a culture that actually is itinerant, moving from place to place, as they would have done for thousands of years, following the food. And there's a whole aspect about that we'll come to later on. Let's have the next slide then. So, interestingly enough, I went to the Museum of Modern Art in Sydney, and this is a very modern picture of Captain Cook. And if you stand in front of this thing, you see a Captain Cook that is almost doubtful about what he's done. Thoughtful, regretful, I don't know. But it's interesting, this Captain Cook sits there and he's sort of thinking, and you stand here looking at this thing, what are the artists trying to communicate here? You know, he's doubting, in a sense, his legacy of what he did. And there is a bit of that in Australia today. There's a lot of politics going on. As some of you know, the government in Australia is very right-wing. In fact, they just had a change of prime minister to an even more right-wing prime minister. And the issues about Aboriginal rights, this thing of a constitutional change, has all been thrown out. There's not going to happen with the current government there, because they're just not even entertaining the thought of trying to sort of do something for the status of Aboriginal people. So just fascinating picture that certainly in some parts of Australia there is a real question mark about what the legacy really is of Captain Cook. Okay, let's have the next slide then. So here we go. So, Northern Territory, Diocese, Darwin. When I was there, I was very fortunate. 50 years old. I did tell them we're 1,300, and I thought, yes, okay. But they're only 50 years old. And it's a funny old place, Darwin. You're at the top of Australia. There is nothing really effectively around the place. You're quite an isolated little place. It's just a strategic town. And the government, Commonwealth government, pays people to go and live there extra, to live and work there. They want to have people go there because it is so far away from everything else. It's quite a tough place to live. It's very hot. And like now, there's a so-called build-up to the wet that's coming. And it's a sort of place, some love to live there, but I have to say, I wouldn't want to live there long-term, that's for sure. So it has a strategic importance. It was a garrison town. You know, there's a massive United States air base around the corner just outside, and they fly those massive big bombers from there, those B-52s. They were based there. There's a lot of American presence up there too. Strategic stuff, you know, with Australian government and Americans and all the rest of it. And they call it there a white fella town. And that's what the local language is. White fella means basically, you know, Aboriginal people really, well, not really welcomed or part of the set up there. And so in the kind of way, if you do see them, they tend to be inebriated. They're probably playing the didgeridoo and trying to get some money from you. But, you know, there's something very broken about those people you do see there who are Aboriginal people. They're not actually living in a community sense at all. So, you know, Darwin, the diocese, all very new. And you feel that newness when you get there. It's not a settled place, really. A lot of ferment, struggle and difficulty. Okay, let's get the next slide then. A little picture of it. I think another slide. I think I've got another bit of picture there. Let's go for another one. So basically, this is Darwin. I mean, it's a tiddly place. There's only about 150,000 people. It does go up more that way. The cathedral is over here. That's the cathedral there. The parliament is there, and that's the high court there. This is the sort of harbour areas, and it's all growing up that way. Big garrison over here, the army's over there. It's quite, it was heavily bombed in the Second World War, if you might remember, and Darwin was bombed rather surprisingly, and was heavily bombed, really, and a lot of it was destroyed. A lot of people died there, and hence it became, after the war, or during the war, just before the Second World War, it became a huge investment in it because of the strategic connection with fighting the Japanese, who were coming and sweeping all over Southeast Asia. So it became much more significant during, well, just before and during the Second World War. After that, it became, once again, it's struggling. And today, when I was up there, it's actually struggling financially too. It's going through a bit of a dip because there was a lot of work being done for gas fields out in the bay, in Coral Bay, not Coral Bay, one of the big bays out there anyway. And now it's come to an end, so everyone's going home, and it's inevitable, another big dip. But that's what it looks like. I've got a little video clip of the harbour, but we'll see if we've got time for that. Okay, let's go for the next slide. So that's a small little town, really. But here's Bishop Greg. This is him, the Bishop of the Northern Territory, Greg Anderson. And this is the cathedral. It's not very big at all. But you see the bit over here? That's the remains of the old cathedral, because it was blown down through one of those big storms they had about 30 years ago, or 40 years ago, in fact. And it was the only remaining standing bit was that. So they rebuilt a whole new building with that still there. They don't use that door anymore, but you go around that side. But Greg is a fascinating man. He actually did a PhD in Aboriginal music. And he speaks about four Aboriginal languages, which is incredible for any bishop that I've ever met who really knows the Aboriginal life and their traditions. But he's a Sydney man. And if you come from Sydney in Australia, it's a very conservative evangelical diocese. No women priests in the diocese at all. And in the Northern Territory, he also has that sort of view. We were challenging it a bit when we were there because he's got this wonderful, connection with Aboriginal people. And yet he comes out of a very conservative stable in the church. And so there was a bit of a real issue because there were a lot of women priests in the diocese too, which of course preceded him. But in Australia, one thing I did pick up, there is a lot of fragmentation in the church. Dioceses do not get on with each other. There are huge issues about child protection and child abuse by clergy, Catholic, Anglican. In Tasmania, there's a practical meltdown of the Anglican Church at the moment, having to sell everything they've got to pay out these millions of dollars that they're going to pay to people who have been abused, because the government have set a kind of minimum amount of money that each person should get. So there's a whole lot of things going on, which is actually quite disturbing, but sad as well. A lot of ferment. But certainly in the Northern Territory diocese, there were some issues in this diocese too, I have to tell you, but great bishop. I got on very well with him. Spent a lot of time with him. Because when you go to somewhere, you've got a four-hour sit with the bishop in the car. So what do you talk about for 4 hours, your granny and grandpa or something. But anyway, we had lots of time to talk about stuff. And I have to say, being not in his employ, you could actually ask the hard questions, and not feel you're going to be fired on the way back, And it was good because, in fact, we had a lot of meetings. One of the lovely occasions was, we had the 50th anniversary celebrations, and a lot of bishops from all over the place came, and even the Archbishop of Brisbane came, and I had a one-to-one with him, which is nice to ask him some tough questions, but about the church. Anyway, let's have the next slide. We've got a lot to do. Time is flying. This is inside the cathedral, very modern, concrete thing. And this is the Dean, Keith. I stayed with him for a bit. Lovely guy. But he trained in the Solomon Islands. And he actually, his heart, if I'll be honest, is in the with the Melanesians. He knows them backwards. And he has a great, he's a philosopher. That's his training. But he's taught in the colleges there for some time. So when I was there, in fact, he went back for a couple of weeks back to the Solomons to meet some colleagues there and do some teaching, I think, as well. But very different from the bishop. Much more Catholic. Bishop much more evangelical. And I couldn't say they exactly got on that well, but they had to, and they were a good, foil for each other. Great chap. Let's have the next slide, then. this is the picture of the bombing. You know, I thought, you know, people, when I got to Darwin, the one thing they keep telling you, they have tours on this thing, is the bombing of Darwin. It's a quite a major event in the minds of the people there today, that they're actually kind of long way from Sydney and Melbourne, and they have a kind of, I wouldn't say an identity of just being a kind of terrorized part of the world. They're not like that. But it is something that is in the minds and hearts of many people, that they have been bombed and that they have a kind of a military kind of element to it. When I got there for Anzac Day, just at the very beginning. Literally, it was the second day it was Anzac Day. 6 o'clock in the morning, we all had to gather at the, there's a huge strip of ground that's called the harbour, really. And the military were just everywhere, you know, because the military from the Americans and everything else. They say it's the closest thing America gets to religion, Australia gets to religion, is Anzac Day. Everyone. I mean, there were children, families, 6 o'clock in the morning, pitch dark still. Everyone gathered. And there were thousands there for the ceremony of remembering the Anzacs, those who died, particularly Gallipoli. But, and since that too. And there were lots of speeches and talks. But, you know, you thought, wow, this obviously pushes a button for the people here. That's a big, big event. And hence a little picky here of that. Okay, let's have the next slide. And here's a picture of it. These are the Americans. This is Anzac Day. They have the early morning ceremonies, and then the whole rest of the day they march to the town. You know, and it's a, you get a feel for the kind of military significance of the city as well. And the thing, you know, some of you would have heard of the RSL, the Returning Services League. It's like our Royal British Legion here, but they have clubs. And they do food and things, but they also do pokies, which are these one-armed bandits. They make their money through gambling, and Australians love gambling. Boy, they have pokies everywhere. And the clubs, the military clubs, actually have this as a kind of like a division, funds all the stuff they do is come and gamble. It's rather, you know, sad, really, but that is how it functions. But I was told in Western Australia, it's the only state where they do not do any gambling. The RSL clubs do not have it. They've banned it. And they're doing better. So there's something to be said about that. Okay, next slide then. That's the high street anyway. Okay, Aboriginal realities. I did a lot of reading on the history of the Aboriginal people. And when you look at the history and you look back to so where they've come from, those appalling episodes of massacre, of persecution, of degradation, of dispossession, because you do feel, when I've met many of them, that they are a kind of people who've lost something of their soul. It just felt to me when I spent time in the back and beyond with these people that they were just a lost people. And the government had a policy. Let me explain very simply, because it's quite complex in some respect, but simply, the initial policy of government, really, when the pastoralists came, was that of protection. And the missions were vitally involved in giving refuge, bringing them into their mission stations, educating them, giving them skills. And the missionaries were always good at that, teaching them English, making them mechanics, teaching them to be stockmen. One of the places I went to, Gumbalanya, they actually had an abattoir. They were skilled people. They were given self-dependency, the ability to be independent and self-sufficient. That was what the missionaries tried to do. Government policy eventually changed just after the Second World War. And the policy was assimilation. They need to become like us. So they told the missions, look, you have to withdraw from what you're doing. The state will come in and do education. We'll do, and you just take a back seat. And the missions did that. They actually stood way back. And what happened through that phase of time, a lot of their education ceased, effectively. They just did not go to school. And we've got a few slides later on about this, but eventually the gap of lack of education grew and grew and grew. And to this day, you know, there is this massive shortage of skilled, trained, eloquent Aboriginal people, because they, when that assimilation program came in, literally a lot of that stopped. Those skills disappeared. The communities were impoverished because basically they rejected what the government was offering them. The educational provision wasn't something they wanted. They just stepped right out of it. And there was no real connection, as the missionaries had, with some of those key communities. And most of those communities, all around Arnhem Land, all stack of them, are all mission station. They were all originally mission station. That's where the communities developed around. And with that process, then, after assimilation, which did not work, because the government believed, and it's actually in a written record, that they believed that within a few decades, the Aboriginal communities would disappear. There would be no more Aboriginal people. They would become like us. They'll be black or shades of it, but Anglo-Saxons like us. That's what they really believed, that they would actually eliminate. And of course, that just would never happen. The Aboriginal people lost a lot of their identity. They lost a lot of their ability to actually be sustainable as communities. They eventually fell into living on the dole, effectively, on handouts from government. They could not run their own business. Eventually, the government policy changed again to self-determination. That's where we are at the moment. But when you've lost everything, how do you actually regain it? And I discovered with the churches that that's a kind of challenge they're in at the moment. How do you actually recapture something of your identity that you've lost with the land, with your language, with the traditions? Now, the missionaries weren't great in terms of affirming the actual culture of the Aboriginal people. And for instance, when someone dies, they have smoking ceremonies with their light green vegetation, and they go around the body, and there's a lot of things being done with smoke and things. All very ancient tradition. Well, in the old days, the missionaries said, well, that's all evil, you know. We're not going to have the didgeridoo either, because that's evil too. Because the didgeridoo, I don't know if you know, but you know, you speak through a didgeridoo. You pray through a didgeridoo. It's not just a musical instrument. It's actually a very powerful part of their customs and traditions. Hence, it's used at some of those very important ceremonies. Well, of course, the missionaries said, well, that's all evil too. What the church is trying to do now is say, actually, those traditions really are important to their culture. How do we bring that into their Christian understanding of, you know, of their own, developing their own liturgies, ways of looking after births, deaths, effectively things like confirmation, this whole thing of the rites of passage that we all know so well. How do we make that authentically Aboriginal? And that's a kind of process that they're beginning to work on, but some way away from it. But it's this recognition, you know, that we have to give them license and permission, which the church is never good at, giving permission. No, you do what we tell you to do. Giving permission for them to actually find their own voice, authentic Australian, original, Aboriginal voice in terms of their faith. I mean, one of the things when I was actually at the when I was at Nuku, when someone dies, they put a big red, kind of like, they paint a red line around the house. And on the house, you can't go in there for 3 months. No one's allowed in there. They kind of vacate the place. And you can't be seen with particular people that you're related to. It's a very fairly complicated way of arrangements of different kinds of how would you call it? They call it a skin. If you get a skin, you get a name, and you get part of a family bond in an Aboriginal culture. And that skin determines all your relationships with all the other different, say, 8 or 10 in the group. And that says who you can marry, who you can talk to, who you can associate with, and there's a lot of rules and regs. But that goes way, way back when they were itinerant people. It worked to stop incest, things like that. Today, of course, it causes a lot of other problems, really, which is a difficulty I'll come to later on about clashing of cultures. But this whole thing of losing identity and how to regain it, I think the church has got a role to play in the Christian communities. But they've got issues, as well, as I mentioned, about having the right people to do it, because they have so few who are educated properly. Okay, let's have the next one. Let's run through this. I'm taking too much time. Just some lovely images of Aboriginal artwork. I found some of it just hugely arresting. These are like little poles here, meeting poles, and I couldn't tell you exactly what's going on in them, but a lot of it is to do with totems. Talk to an Aboriginal person, they'll tell you they have a totem, which is there linked with, say, the lizard or the catfish or something, but it tends to locate them in a particular place to the ground, the land. And they have this fundamental belief that they've come from the ground and the land. And there's a real connection with location and with the geology, the shapes of the mountains. And it's, you sort of suddenly realize, well, for an Aboriginal person living in a particular place and having a view that I belong and I am a part of this actual physical world around me, there's a real connection there, which we, for us is like bizarre in a sense, but you can understand it. Goes back a long time. It makes them the people they are, the land and from which they have come, and the shape of it all, and the totems that connect them to it. Very, really important, which has been obviously just neglected and ignored, really, by the churches, certainly. I found some people, certainly the Aboriginal leaders, who in their 60s and 70s, 70s more of them, and they're all dying off, really, no real leadership coming up behind, very reluctant to let go of the old story of the missions that were taught in the 50s and the 60s. They're very much still the view of that's not Christian. We can't deal with that. But slowly, I think that's changing. Let's go run through a few more pictures here. Okay. Let's see, here we go. Now, there's a lot of the Aboriginal tribes, if not all of them, met at Uluru not too long ago. And they wrote a statement called the Statement of the Heart. And it starts like this. Gathered at the 2017 National Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders tribes, the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands possessed it under our own laws and customs. This is the first paragraph of the Statement of the Heart. If you Google it, Statement of the Heart, I'm not going to produce the whole thing here. But they met to actually put together to the government of Australia what they want, who they are, and how they see themselves being recognized in some kind of treaty, like the Treaty of Waitangi in New Zealand. And they had this, what's got a lot of coverage, and they presented it to the government. The government put a line right through it. They just said, you can't have that. What it essentially they're asking for is a change in the constitution of Australia, which is a very high one. When the Brits set it up, give an example, 2/3 of every state has to agree to what they are asking for. And only when 2/3 of every of the states, and not the territories, just the states, agree, then you know they could change it. And their chances of that happening were very, very low, they were saying. Anyway, they've just put a line through it. But you get this impression that the Aboriginal people are looking for a status, for a place in the country that gives them, as they ought to have, as the first people of Australia, a particular identity and status, which they don't have. And it looks to me is that that's not really happening at the moment, and I can't see it happening for some time to come. But nevertheless, they are fighting for this recognition that they were the first people there. It wasn't a terra nullius. They should have been given a recognition like the Maoris in New Zealand, which never happened. And a great injustice was done and has yet to be put right. That's where they're coming from. But it's worth reading. It's a wonderful document that they put down. Okay, let's have the next slide. Sorry, but you can't read the corner there. Now, the realities. I have to say, I found this quite tough when I was out there, particularly in the communities where I went to live and work with them. These are the kind of things. Prevalence of chronic diseases such as type 2 diabetes. Diabetes, I don't know if it's a genetic thing, but it is rampant. And it affects everybody, young men and women do particularly. But they have an addiction to Coca-Cola. I have to say, Coca-Cola is everywhere. You get paid in Coca-Cola. Even the cathedral, when I was there, this chap who works in the garden there, at the fridge, it was round the corner from my office, stacked full of Coca-Cola. So I said to them, you know, this is the problem here. We're helping kill these people here by giving some money and then, you know, 8 cans of Coca-Cola. And of course, we said, well, let's make a Diet Cola. No, they don't like that. You know, they won't take it. And these are, just said everything here. You know, this is this, a real issue with their health. Massive problems with that. Cardiovascular disease, chronic, smoking. They smoke a lot. Very serious. They had the highest suicide rate of young people in the world is in the Northern Territory. Young men, 18 to 21s, so that kind of age range, who take their own lives, young men. Just shocking. And you ask, well, why is that? Well, it's mental health problems. Serious mental health. It's all to do with the fact that they are a broken people. And I spent some time with the chief doctor at the local, well, there's a massive youth prison outside of south of Darwin, where they send young people, young offenders, of the whole country to this. 80% are young Aboriginal men, 80%. And many of them have convictions as long as your arm and are on drug addictions of one kind or another. You know, lots of different diseases. They have euphemistic ways of speaking about things. It's called sorry business. You talk to an Aboriginal man or woman, they have to go on sorry business, which is usually someone's died. And even when I was at Cathedral, this chap who worked, who drank all the coke, I mean, he had to go off to Brisbane. Someone died in his family. And he goes off for 3 weeks. And Aboriginal people do this all the time. It's just their custom. You know, if someone dies, the requirement for you to be at that funeral and to be up and play your part is non-negotiable. But it is so, so prevalent. And, I mean, the bishop had a comment to me. He said, you know, you can imagine a community where the sorry business is every second week. It's unrelenting. People dying young. Tragedies like suicides. When I was out there, I was just so aware, you know, that, you know, you it just was everywhere. And on my phone, I've got a wonderful app, which I this is the sort of thing that you get when you're over there. It's called ComDoc. And what you do, if you go to the doctor and you want to ask a question, I say, select a language. So let me select a language that I sort of like, Goodwinku. Now, Goodwinku is a language spoken in the north of there we are. That's, I think it's done. Now, I want to say, I am your doctor.
I am my doctor.
See? What's your name? The thing is, communication is such a problem. People have gone into hospital for a kidney problem and come out with their liver removed. I mean, you know, things like that. I mean, some terrible things have happened because how to communicate, who speaks in the Aboriginal community, the whole relationship between an older person and a younger person is complicated. They won't talk to a young person about certain things. They just don't do it. And mistakes are made, and communication mistakes are made, and in the medical world particularly, lots of awful things have happened there. Because the ill health is just such a problem. Everyone has, you know, got a problem of one kind or another. And you look at a young person, you think, well, this is a young man, 25, and he's already got issues with his kidneys. He's got renal failure because of usually diabetes or something connected with that. I find it really depressing. And I can see why a lot of young people, Aboriginal people, struggle to sort of see hope in their situation and rather just opt out of the whole thing. There was one event when I was in Alice Springs. I wasn't in Alice Springs, but we were in Catherine. There was some kind of gathering of some people in Alice Springs. Anyway, I think 12 cars were smashed up by some young people. They just went along and just smashed them up because they just feel such an antipathy toward the establishment, you know, of Australia, and the things work for other people but not for us. You know, let's have the next slide. Well, Arnhem Land, vast, small populations. Let's have the next slide, see what pictures I've got of that. See if there's anything here. Here's Arnhem Land. Here's Nukur. This is where I spent a lot of time here. That's where we were. And the Gumbalanya, or Oompeli, is where I spent a lot of time over there. And this is Arnhem Land here, and you can see Darwin's further. There's Gallywinkle, Millingimby. A lot of people here, this is the Gove Peninsula, a lot of mining there, a lot of money being made. Bauxite, I think it is. Lots of stuff happening within the Aboriginal communities all over Arnhem Land. But between these places, there's absolutely nothing but bush. You can drive for hours and you don't see a single person. There's not a community, there's nothing there at all, other than wild animals. Particularly, funnily enough, you know, things like water buffalo. They brought water buffalo there, I think, in the 1800s, and they've all just gone wild, really, in these huge things roaming the bush, basically. But essentially, this is the area that, the diocese actually works in. Most of this is Anglican. Okay, next slide. Now, one of the places I really wanted to go to, the Roper Mission, was on the Roper River, where Nukur was, on that map, right on the bottom corner. In the old days, the only way to get there, you had to go by boat all the way around Cape York, and Thursday Island is an island right on top, which was a kind of major mission station, and they would come down the Gulf of Carpentaria, right down to the Roper River, then go up a few miles. This, as the next slide you'll see, is what it says. With thankfulness to your mighty God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and member of the pioneer missionaries of the Church Missionary Society, who established the Roper River Mission 1908, 30th of August. This is the next slide. And you get a picture of me. That's me there. And this is the obelisk here. And this is Andrew. He's a priest. Well on in years anyway. But this is the original place, which is, I thought, just such a wonderful place to go to, where they started the very first mission up in that part of the world. It was so isolated. To get to this place, it was just a phenomenon. The people who went there were passionate about the faith and giving the people there the good news of our Lord Jesus Christ. They went there to this place where you think, gosh, how difficult was it to get there? And it's difficult to get there now, never mind then. And we were just so happy to go. And this is Andrew, who is actually, you know, very, very passionate about the history of this place, because the community has moved a few miles away because it gets flooded here. And they've had some serious floods. In fact, it wiped out the whole community, I think, just after the war. Because when the Roper River floods, it's a mighty river. Let's have the next slide. And you'll see some pictures of it. This is the original entrance here. This is where they came off. This is the Roper River. It's a big river. And this is where they originally came. Here's another picture, I think. Let's have an endless picture here. And that's the size of the river. Full of crocodiles. We're told, the big board says, don't get near the edge because they can see you. You won't see them. And you know, they've got you. And it's absolutely chock-a-block of salty. They call them salties because you can't shoot crocodiles. They're protected. So they've just proliferated and proliferated. And they're just, and some of them are 5-6 meters long. I mean, they're huge, absolutely huge. So I kept my distance. I just snapped and went back. But you won't believe this. For baptisms, they used to, not anymore, they've been banned, they used to have baptisms in the river. And they'd have members of the congregation stand in a semicircle from the bay, looking out, and behind them the baptism would happen to keep the crocs. The crocs wouldn't come if there were too many of you around, you see. So they made a little ring like that, and the baptisms would happen in the so-called safer area in the middle. And they would do that in this river, I have to say, quite amazing. Because they still believed baptizing in the river was what the Bible taught. That was it. Into the river you go. And they just did it for years and years and years. But there's a lovely picture of the Roper River, right near the Gulf of Carpentaria. Let's have the next slide. And you can see some of the foundations of the old buildings of the Roper Mission. I'm just so excited to walk around there and feel the kind of history of the place, the kind of pioneering spirit of the people who came, because there really were, I mean, you know, a week away from help. You know, it was just, you were just isolated, and yet they were hugely successful in the sense of creating a community there. And I was saying to you at the beginning that one of the big issues really is that you've got an itinerant culture and you've got a sedentary culture. And of course, they came and went and came and went because they wanted to go and live in the bush and travel and walk and all the rest of it. And yet the missionaries were saying, well, you've got to stay here, learn English, learn a craft, get a skill. And that's what they did. Very effectively, and yet that there was a great trust that was built up, great fellowship. And to the credit of the missionaries in those days, those missionaries today who are in their 60s and 70s who benefited hugely from this are very, very committed people and wonderful, wonderful Christians. But a real challenge is the future. I came away thinking, well, the next 20, 30 years, what will be here? What Christian witness will there be? Because there's a real crisis, I think, on the horizon. Okay, let's have the next slide. Okay, this is my house. Not that one over there. I lived over there, in that through this doorway there. This is the mission house in Nukur. And this is this other bit was let out to some other chap. So that was where I lived. A small little house, just perfect, really. It had all the proper loos and things, and no snakes, because everything's off the ground. Everything's up, you know, because I did see some snakes, but they weren't in my house, thank goodness. So everything's on stilts, and also the termites are a massive problem, so you've got to be on metal stilts. They don't like going up metal things, apparently, so that's how they do it. Everything's on stilts. Okay, next slide. This is the high street of Nukur, and the shop is in there. This is all diesel over here because it's miles away and it's a frightfully expensive place. A loaf of bread will cost you $4.50. A loaf of bread. Everything is really expensive. You've got to travel to Darwin first, and Darwin's expensive. Go to Nukur, it's even more expensive. How people live and pay for this. To pay $4.50 for a loaf of bread was just shocking. And people are ripped off massively. The poorest people have the worst possible deal here. And they, around the corner, they opened a 7-Eleven, which wasn't a proper 7-Eleven. And I went to talk to some of the Chinese people who own it. And it is the worst food possible, fast food they're making here. But they're queuing up to buy it. Fat, all horrible stuff, really. The worst thing to eat for them. And it wasn't cheap either. But it just is a kind of cultural issue that they're all lining up to buy it. And probably, you know, it's going to do them a lot of damage in the long run. But the Chinese people saw a gap in the market because inside here there's a little cafe too. Probably a little more healthier things to eat there. But this is the high street, you know, a little bit of tarmac. The rest of it's all dirt road, really. But it's all run sort of by the community. But when I was there, the place was robbed. Next door to this is a kind of big warehouse, and I came down one day, and the gates were clearly had been broken, and all the supplies that were in the yard there were all taken. So I thought, and this is owned by the community, so I thought they're robbing themselves in a funny kind of way. But there wasn't a policeman inside, you know. There isn't any police presence in this community at all. So how they dealt with it, I don't know. But just this, but the sad and depressing, really. But criminality. But also one other thing is domestic violence. Became a good friend at the cathedral in Darwin. He was a dentist. Lovely guy. His name was Simon Peter. Peter was his surname. I don't know how it works, Simon Peter. Anyway, he traveled to all those communities around, you know, flying, very expensive to fly there on these light aircraft. I mean, I thought of flying to one of these other places, Groote Eylandt, was $1,000. Just for a short hop flight. I thought I couldn't afford that. But he flies around as a dentist. And most of the time, he's either doing extractions or rebuilding teeth of women that have been smashed by men who've hit them. And the violence, the domestic violence, as alcohol-driven, most of it's alcohol or drugs. Because petrol sniffing, you won't believe it, but petrol sniffing is what the young people do. You can't imagine, you know, the damage it does, but that's... They do. They have special petrol there now that you can't sniff, but they still do it. Mental illness and the damage it does to young people with their, you know, they're growing in their brains and things, just terrible. But domestic violence is just quite shocking, actually. And you do see it quite a lot around the place, really. I even witnessed it at a Christian convention. I think I've got a few pictures coming up of that, too. We went to Catherine for the Christian convention. I might leave it for a little bit later, that story, because there's a slide coming up. It's got lots to do. Let's go. I'll come back to that, hopefully. This is a normal house. You can't see it here, but this is one of the clergy of... It's a not very good picture, is it, really? It would look better than that. But they do have a lot of rubbish lying around the place. The only piece of the village that's really well kept is the AFL pitch. Australian football, rugby, you know. They absolutely love it. And that pitch is immaculate. The rest of the place is falling down, you know. It's just the way to do it. And they say it's because of their kind of cultural, their itinerant culture. You just drop things. You don't put things away. You just leave them where they are. But things don't biodegrade. They're plastic. So the place is full of that, and full of cars that are falling apart as well. But that's just part of the culture there. There's a real issue. You think, gosh, do they look after their houses? And they, no, they don't, I'm afraid. It's just it's pretty mucky and dirty. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Now, Anglicare, this is one of the great things about the church there, is that it actually works with government to produce or deliver certain services like parenting, mum and baby units, that kind of thing. Because the thing is, there's a real crisis really about young families not getting proper nutrition, proper help in terms of developing them and stimulating them. You know, all the usual stuff that we take for granted here. And Anglicare, these are the three workers here who are working in Nooka. And Anglicare, the bishop, and quite a few of the clergy, they're on the board of this thing. And there's a multi-million dollar thing where they work with government, which I think is just an amazing kind of collaboration where the church is doing something really, really powerful. And in places that are remote like this, there are people there who have been well-trained, who are well-financed, and actually are fantastic at working in the communities, trying to actually, you know, fight the great challenges of family breakdown, community breakdown, which has come as a result of that government policy of assimilation and now self-determination. Really, the place is falling apart in many respects. The church and all these organizations are trying to save the lives of young children, you know. Give an example. There's a thing called humbug. I learned this quickly. Humbugging in Aboriginal culture. Just say Ron here has a shop, and his shop is full of lovely goodies. But Ron is my brother or my nephew or one of my family. I can come to Ron's shop and say, Ron, yeah, I need some baked beans and some tobacco or something. And they just walk in and help themselves. Because humbugging, within the family rate, you have an obligation to share. And once again, it comes back from the days when they lived in the bush, you know, centuries ago. That's how you survived. You had to share. You had to work together. It doesn't work in the community like a sedentary kind of community we got today. And Ron will be out of business if we all came along and just helped ourselves to what wants to go. But the same thing, if I've got a car and one of my relatives doesn't have a car and he says, I need to borrow your car, you have an obligation to say, well, here's the key. You know, whether he's going to smash it or not, you have no idea, but, you know, you give him the key. And it's the same with money, same with a lot of things. And humbugging doesn't always work very well, but it is very prevalent. Give you another example. There's another chap who will come up later on here, a chap called Craig. I think he was being ordained as a deacon this year. A lot of time with him. One of the hopeful figures, really, in the community. He has got four kids. And one of his cousins came to visit from another town. They stayed a week, and then they left. But this cousin left without his six kids. He left the six children with Craig. And Craig had an obligation to look after those six kids because the cousin couldn't. And off they went. And that just, you know. So when I went to his house to visit there, I couldn't believe the number of the kids in the house here. I said, you know, yeah, explain. This is just how it works. And he's up to here. You know, he's just about keeping it together. But that is how things can work there. I'm just I'm bewildered. Can you imagine someone like that coming to your house and leaving their kids with you and saying, oh, I can't manage it. And that's what the kind of reality is, you know, which is just mind-boggling. But that is what happens and does happen quite a bit. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Now, little pictures of this is the unit where they are, where they have the consulting rooms and the kind of base in Nooka. It's a wonderful place. There's some wonderfully hopeful things happening there, which is fantastic. Okay, let's go on. Let's press on. I'm just so conscious of the time already. 3:00. There's a little picture that was outside here. I mean, you know, the thing is with the Aboriginal people, they're all very much, as I was saying, too, located in different parts of the country. And you'll find all the names of the different Ngandi is a language or a group, a tribe. And they have the different totems here, you know, fish or whatever that is, some kind of thing, an alligator or a crocodile. They have lots of different ways of understanding where they fit in. And I have to say, there's something which is quite amazing about Aboriginal people. They are connected with their tribal, different tribal relationships. They know who they are. They know where they slot in. And it's something that's almost, you know, from birth, actually, they know where they are. One of the pluses of it, they are connected. And yet, it doesn't seem to work because there's a lot of breakdown in all kinds of family, community difficulties that don't matter. But there is this thing, these little paintings explain to them where they slot in, what they're in relationship with, and it's even some of the features of the mountains and hills and things. Okay, let's go to the next slide. This is the AFL pitch. Look at that. Not a bit of rubbish on there. There's no rubbish on there. It's absolutely immaculate. The only bit of the town that is. Okay, next slide. And this is the one of the streets that goes, well, down the side. And a lot of the ministers that I knew, they lived down there. But you can see it just goes on forever. It's just flat as a pancake, really. And it's just vast blue sky every day. 35 degrees every day. But not humid. It was still the dry season, thankfully. Okay, next slide. And here is Craig. This is the man who's got all those kids. And this here is a chap called Dallas. Now, just to give another indication of how I had to learn to bite my lip. Because in Aboriginal society, you know, they have elders and their ways of doing it. If you get something done, you've got to know the right people and you've got to work through a system. This chap here is going to be, well, I think he's a big ordained deacon now. But he had a kind of brief for young families and young people in the community to try and help them. Minister amongst the younger in the community of the Christian community. This chap here is a youth worker for the Roper Council. The Rope and Gulf is the name of the council there. They related, but you know, everyone's related, I suppose. And I said to him, well, do you get, and he plays in a band, this guy, and he sang me a few songs. And I thought, gosh, he can sing well. Great, lovely band. He's obviously doing a lot of things with young people. Well, what about you and him getting together and maybe doing something with young people in the village, trying to get going with, you know, something, you know. They don't talk to each other on that. Oh, no, we can't, you know, work together because of the way the structures of the society work. I said, what about planning something, you know. And I suddenly realized, you know, we come with our Western thing, oh, let's get an agenda, we're going to plan this, and there's a whole structure, and we get a result. It doesn't work like that there. And that's a tragedy of it to some extent, is that the way things work in communities like this really is difficult to get things done. And to some extent, there is a problem how to get things off the ground with the church community that they have. Because people like these guys, you think, two youngish men, surely, you know, they can collaborate and get things together. And yet I sat there with them thinking, well, no, it's just not going to work. You know, it's a real depressing part of it. Anyway, just a little insight into the realities of how things work in the city, in the town there. Okay, next slide is, we're going to have to trundle through fast. I was already five past. This is Carol. She's a priest in Nooka. But nothing works that you expect. For instance, on Sundays, you expect there to be an act of worship on a Sunday. You know, and I was told there was going to be one in the evening, and you pitch up. And it doesn't happen. No one's there. And so, you know, you have to realize that things just do not, no one wears a watch. No one's got a diary. It's all happens when it happens. And that's just another, that's very, very frustrating. But then you have to say to yourself, well, Andre, this is another world. They just don't operate like we do. And, you know, lovely people, really hospitable. But that kind of organizational kind of thing doesn't actually sort of count for much there, which is a real problem, because you need to have some, you need to plan, you need to get together and get some planning going, and it doesn't work so well over there. And I just had to learn and live with it. But they're lovely people. And this is the Bodie bus here. This is the bus you get on to travel to these dirt road end of dirt. And they, absolute nightmare. That bus travels like the light, and it rattles, and you get bounced around like a jelly baby at the back. Anyway, it's another experience. Let's have the next slide. And that's a daughter there. I like this. Dead car removal. And the funny thing was, I didn't see any dead cars get removed. I think they like their dead cars because they were just, there's loads of dead cars. And they, when they break down, I mean, the garage, there's no garages there, so basically they just leave it where it breaks down, and they just left there. And you find them in the middle of the bush, you know, these and they're all Land Cruisers. And they're not cheap cars, but they just leave them. And I don't know, they're financing some other way. Anyway, next slide. This is a typical house. You see the, and the rule is also, when you go approach an Aboriginal person's house, you don't go beyond the gate. You stand at the gate, like Craig's house, and you stand and you shout, "Craig!" And "Craig!" And another time, and eventually someone comes out the door. What's going on? Because they're not actually working. There's no work in this place. But you don't walk onto their place without being met at the gate and brought in if they want you to do that. And very particular about their homes and about what and what, where you can go. And you have to be very careful about that. It's just one of those things you learn very quickly. But this is a typical house, on a stilt, and it's just inside. I have to say, it is just not painted out nicely at all. It's a bit of a mess, I have to say. They're just not into that kind of thing, of having house-proud people. It is just a bit of a tip everywhere, really. But that is how they live, and it's to do with the fact that they are a culture very different from ours. And the challenge is, because right back to my key thing about how do you actually bring the good news, how do you bring or allow them to bring forth their own kind of way of looking at life and genuinely, authentically being Christians, different from us. And they're saying, great, you just do it differently from us. Okay, let's go to the next slide. There's a school. I brought some things with me. This is the Roper River. This is their school uniform. And that's colourful, isn't it? That's Nooka's school uniform. Yeah, that's where they come to school. If they come to school, half of the children don't go to school. And of the half that do go to school, they might go one day a week. And I spent some time with a head teacher there, and they have these teachers who go and do 3-4 years. They get paid a premium to go to work in these schools. And I spent some time with the head teacher and the deputy head there. Lovely people, basically trying to find out where the kids are, most of the time. But the thing is, there's this turnover. The people come, the people go, the people come. And the issues of this school is a lovely school in some respects. I mean, I had a good look at it. They provide meals, lovely meals every day, lunchtime, free meals for them. But kids just aren't there. They're everywhere else but in school. And so, the educational levels are just so, so poor, really poor. And no real solution. Let's start flying through these because I think we're going to have to get through them. Okay, I like this. This is rain time. That's cold water, hot water. So this is how and fast rain time is, that's called the language that is used mostly in the middle of Arnhem Land is a kind of mixture of English and a little bit of, Aboriginal, really. And it's called Creole for short. And some of the stuff, the spellings are really strange, but it's just very much part of it. This is just a thing of seasonal picture. I thought I quite liked that, with all the different images that they have of the seasons. Okay, let's have the next slide. Okay, 50 years old. Let's have the next picture. We're going to start heading through here. This lady here, she's the administrator. An administrator is like the Prime Minister and the Lord Lieutenant rolled into one. But they're not a state, they're a territory, so she doesn't have the same kind of gravitas. But she essentially is the CEO of the government of the Northern Territory. There's the bishop. This is the dentist. There he is, Simon Peter. And there's the dean. And you see what he's wearing on his cross? That is from the Solomon Islands. And these teeth here, a whole lot of teeth, dolphin teeth. And so what a priest would wear in the Solomon Islands. But we had a big sort of showcasing a lot of stuff on the 50th anniversary. And you see this lady here? She's the principal, and she's wearing one of these. She's the principal of Nungalinga College. And it says that this is what their strapline is, empowering Indigenous people. And I have to say, I did have many a conversation with her what that really means, because it is a really challenging suggestion that they are empowering Indigenous Christians, because the challenges, once again, there are humongous. Okay, so that's her, and a really important person. There's the next slide. And this is all outside. We had a big do outside for the 50th anniversary, a big Eucharist service, which I videoed as well. I sent them a copy of that. But a lot of people gathered outside, clergy and friends all around. There's not just any fraction of them. Let's have the next slide. And yeah, the bishops. Now, this chap here is Greg Thompson. I'll tell a little story about him, because in fact, it's really interesting. He was the dean of the cathedral, and he became bishop of Newcastle, which is a big city, you know, on the east coast of Australia. Yeah. And they had a royal commission into child abuse in the church. Some of you might have read this, because it was in the media here too. And he actually went to testify as a victim, because he was abused whilst at theological college. Can you believe that? He was a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, something like that. And as a result of his testimony, he felt he had to resign his bishopric. So he basically resigned as a bishop of Newcastle. And he's, I'm not sure exactly what he's doing now, but he came up, and it was just wonderful meeting someone like this who's passionate about the church and its work with Aboriginal people too. But, you know, had his own sufferings and the kind of real realities of life that he's had. But this chap here is Philip. He's the Archbishop of Brisbane. This is a Bishop Clyde. He was, I think, the second, or was he the first bishop of the diocese? The bishop and his wife, Keith, and there's a previous dean. And it was lovely to meet them. This is where we had the dinner. This is where we had our long powwow about what's going on in the church, in the Australian church. And Philip here, I have to say, he was amazingly honest about the fact that the Australian church has so many problems, fractures and difficulties. It isn't a united, because one of the things that came to me, my mind, was that to solve some of the problems of, certainly in the Northern Territory, are so huge. The diocese is so small, it's got no resources to speak of. It should be something that the whole Anglican Church in Australia is looking at seriously to try and address, because the resources in the Northern Territory are a drop in the ocean. How do you get the, and he's saying to me, forget it. The Australian Church, no chance. Are they going to sort of collaborate to try and do something that actually would help the mission of the church with Aboriginal men to find their own voice, as I was saying, to find that sort of their place in Australia, you know? So that's a big, big challenge. Okay, lovely people, wonderful time that was. Okay, this is trundle through the cultural clash. Let's go for it and see where we go. Time is flying. This is Nanganga College, that's the principal. And, you know, this is the T-shirts that, well, this is their kind of, you know, T-shirt that they all wear. And I spent some time here almost every couple of days, every single day I was there, spending time with some of the students, working with some of them. And these were the creme de la creme, if you like, the best people in the communities who were sent to Nanganga College to be trained as leaders and ministers in the different communities from all over Arnhem Land. These people came from literally the whole of the Northern Territory. There were people from Alice Springs. And I met quite a few of them. Now, most of these people, or most of them, a good chunk of them, could not read and write. And these are the people that were sending up. I spent some time in some of their class. They'd be painting. That's what they could do. Reading and writing, they just had, well, that generation, as I was mentioning, well, that just basically lost out of any education, because there was the pullback from the missionaries and the state came in and things didn't happen. It all went pear-shaped. A lot of these people really struggle with that. And they have a thing called Certificate 1, 2, and 3, and they are the top one is Certificate 3, where they can read and write, and there is some ability for them to learn and be taught and go away with some skills for their communities. But you can see the challenge. If these are the best people they're sending up, wow, you know, there's a real issue here of how do you bring forth a generation of young, or not so young, but eloquent people who can advocate, you know, for the Aboriginal tribes in a way that makes some difference in for the state and for the church. Because I'd thought, gosh, there weren't that many here who could make that impact. Okay, there's the next slide. Here's Rodney and Richard. Richard from Millingimby, this chap, yeah? And he is from Hermannsburg. Anybody know what Hermannsburg is? Anyone can remember Hermannsburg? Pretty famous, because they have a wonderful choir that's traveled the world. an Aboriginal choir. They've been to all over the place. And they sing Aboriginal songs on the old German, great German hymn tunes. And they travel the world singing, because apparently those songs have been forgotten. They went to Germany to sing them in Germany, and they were absolutely gobsmacked there. But the thing is, Hermannsburg is a Lutheran part of the world. And he's a cook, chef. And he was sent up to be trained. And you can see he looks pretty grim-faced, right? He looks a bit as if he's not happy. But every Friday morning we had a breakfast, well, late breakfast. Come and have some food. And we met the people. And you can see what you eat, watermelon and all that kind of stuff, you know, for breakfast or for food and sandwiches. Lovely guys, actually. But they were going back. They come for 3 weeks. Then they go back. They come for 3 weeks. And they go back. And then they're not in students like we have, you know, doing a whole semester. They have little bits and back and forth they come. And the plan is when they get to Certificate 3, these both were Certificate 3, that they would go back and be, as I said, Jen Stratmark, empowered Christians in their communities to do things. But you did see the kind of challenges were like Everest. Honestly, you know, what they learned here and what they could take with them back to their communities wasn't that great, really, because they're just starting off from such a low base. But lovely, wonderful. Here's a picture of the college, Nungalinga College. This is the wall outside the buildings in Darwin. Okay, let's have the next slide. And that's a little thing, hanging in the chapel there, Emmanuel. Sort of thing they'd paint and they would do. It was very impressive, very nice. Okay, next slide. Now, when I was there, I was also fortunate enough to go to on the Diocesan Conference, which was down in Catherine. The five-hour drive down south to get there. This is the entire diocese. That is the entire diocese of its clergy. And quite a few of these people here, we were given, they've one of these things you get given in the diocese. They have a bookmark with the faces of all the Aboriginal clergy in the diocese. So there's 16 clergy in the diocese. They're not all actually there, but they all basically are like parish priests in those communities, all these people here. And the white people that you can see there, they tend to be clergy in Darwin or in Alice Springs or in Tennant Creek. Those are the main kind of places. But we had a fantastic time sharing together their stories of how they do. Because at such a vast place, I mean, the people on Groot Island, it's a big island off the coast in Carpentaria, a big island called Groot Island, or in Dutch, Groot Eiland, though it's called, because it's a Dutch name really, are so far away. And it's so expensive to get anyway. They can never get seen. So this annual gathering is really important for them to come and talk about their stories. Others get there, but we don't. This meeting is such an important gathering of that. And we had a wonderful time. This chap over here from Sydney came and did a talk with us. And it was excellent. I have to say, I was very encouraged. And they're all wonderful, wonderful people. I've got all their names over here of the people who are on the photograph here. Let's have the next slide. Now, these are the three ladies from Groot Island. Let me tell you their names. I couldn't even remember their names offhand. I'll tell you who they are, because they are just astonishing people, really. This is Millie. And that's Colleen over there. And Gangwa is over here. And they are the most exciting Christians you would want to meet. So full of bubble. Full of faith and in energy, and yet they're in a place that you could say is the most deprived part of the whole of the diocese. They live on a little island where there's hardly any resources, really, and they live in this remote place, but just incredible people. And the hope of the church are people like this, although they're not exactly young, are they? Most of the clergy, of certainly the Aboriginal clergy, are very old, 70s, even in the 80s. And it's just rather sad that there is a problem. Who's going to come up and take their places? Who are the next bit of clergy? And it's not clear at all, really. Okay, let's have the next Next slide. Okay. Are there any conclusions? But can I just say one thing? Okay, let's go for the next conclusions and see. I think I've got another slide here. Let me just explain. I've got some videos here. Let me show you a quick little video, because I did set it up, of my event down at, when I went down to Catherine. This will give you an idea. Oh, why is it not? Oh, wait a minute. Does it do anything? Yeah. I love the girl in the little blue dotted dress there, or the other one trying to follow things, yeah. To stop it, I think, but now the reason why I want to show you that, the reason why I've got that on the screen, I just thought, isn't it odd that these are Aboriginal people dancing to an American song in a Christian convention? I thought to myself, isn't it incredible? Why aren't they doing something that is more authentically Aboriginal? And it says a lot about how the church has worked, and particularly the more evangelical mission organizations like CMS. It's been very, very, very Western-oriented. And I'll give you an example. When I was at this conference, we were all camping in tents. I camped with the Nuku people in a big sort of showground outside of Catherine. And we had a speaker who came from Sydney. And he was an Aboriginal man, but probably, I don't know, 1/8, something like that. He wasn't really dark-skinned, a chap called Neville Naden. And he came and gave us, as they do at all these kind of like conferences, a Bible exposition over, I don't know, 3 sessions. Lots of PowerPoint, lots of text, lots of speaking. And I spoke to the people I was staying with, the leaders of the Nuku Church, and I camped right next door to them. And Marjorie was one of the leaders. She was a priest. I said to her, Marjorie, well, do you understand this man? Do you get what he's saying on the screens there? All the text? No, nothing at all. They just don't get it. It's just, this man comes from Sydney, even though he's an Aboriginal man, he is saying, look, become like me. This is the future. Become a Western, you know, chappie who's conversant with life in the big city. And they say, we do not want the big city. We do not want what you are. And they have these guys come in and do these conferences, which is, I mean, it was a quality piece of work he did, but it meant practically zero to the people who came to it. Now, these people had traveled literally thousands of miles to get here. Cost a fortune for them to get there. And they got nothing wrong. But this kind of thing, every evening we had this, where they love to move and do the thing to songs. And I just thought to myself, isn't it amazing that this is another bit of imperialism, if you like, in terms of their culture. They're dancing to some kind of Americanized song, doing actions which they quite like, but is it really what they're meant to be doing? Is this going to help them find that identity? Thanks for coming. And the thing is, you had to say to yourself, I just found it rather depressing that this is what they were doing, and this is what they were actually being given. Rather than saying, okay, well, why don't you give us an Aboriginal dance here? Let's do something, you know, where they do their, you know, we saw a lot of the stuff being done elsewhere. And sadly, it wasn't, you know, to be. They had a lot of this, and I can see where it's come from. It's a kind of Christianity which I think, well, it is foreign to them. And yet they're dancing to it. And I don't know if they really like it, but it's come out of a kind of a stable of the church. And I just find it, well, you know, surely they should be finding something that's authentically their own. But they've not been given the space for it because the place is run. I mean, I had a meeting with some of the leaders of it. It's run by a lot of white men from Sydney. Already, you know. And was there any representation of Aboriginal people? No. You think, why not? It said everything about just how these things are planned and what it says about this kind of, you know, as lovely as it is and as beautiful as it is, it just isn't really them. One little story. When I was at the cathedral, one of the clergy there, Sue, her husband died, and I got to know him a little bit. He was quite poorly, and he had a skin. He worked up in Millingimby for many, many years. When he died, as is the tradition there, everyone comes from the tribal family for the funeral, which was held in the cathedral. And once again, couldn't video anything, photograph anything. But we had a lot of this going in one corner. But at the end of it, there were two chaps who was like sumo wrestlers, two Aboriginal men, young men. I think they're probably late 20s. They came and did a dance around the coffin on either end of it. And it was, I cannot describe it to you, but it was the most moving dance you can ever see of two men dancing an Aboriginal dance. Normally it would be in the sand because they bring their feet up like that and they stamp and they were doing it on the concrete floor, as the cathedral was a concrete floor. But it was with such passion and with such beauty. Can't describe it to you, but it was one of those moments of the whole 3 months there. I thought, wow, this is what we should have really going on here. And there was a little of it. And partly this, the dean would say, amen. The bishop might think, maybe not. There lies the kind of issue really about this whole cross-cultural challenge of how to bring the Christian faith into a place where people can find their own authentic voice. I saw a bit of it there around that coffin. It was beautiful and wonderful. And this chap who worked in that place and why they gave him the, because he belonged to the family up there. And he was given the treatment as if he were, and as he was, a brother in the family of that tribe. And it was just one of those moments you think, well, that is what we should be heading towards. And the challenge for the church there is very much along those lines. Okay, let's see what... I had a few more things to say at the end, because I know we're running out of time. It's now already 2:30. Let's see. Is there a few other things? 3:30, rather. So the main point here, I think wonderful, faithful people who work... I really think I was so impressed with some of the people I met. Wonderful Christians have been faithful for many, many years. But many of them were in a kind of tradition that was, they grew up in the 50s and the 60s. Real dearth of people coming through to take things forward. Deep problems, not just health problems, but the political landscape. Also very difficult. I had a meeting with a Speaker of the Parliament, which had a wonderful session with her. And she was talking to me about how the Northern Territory government are trying to put together a treaty. If the Commonwealth won't do it, we'll do it. Very passionate in doing something. I was very impressed by that, that even though it's a white fella kind of place, they recognize that they need to do something with a treaty, and they're planning to do that. But they are a territory, not a state, and they have to submit it to the Commonwealth government, and they know it's not going to go anywhere. So they'll probably put a line through. You might recall a few years ago, they were the first country or sort of country in the world to legislate for euthanasia. Do you remember that some years ago? They were the first territory kind of government, and they submitted, of course, radical as it was in those days, to the Commonwealth government, and the Commonwealth government just tore it up. And they couldn't do it. That's just how it works there. They are not a state, and they don't have that kind of authority. But there is hope. There are people there who are trying to sort of say, we've got to do something. Because that kind of sickness, if you like, within the community of the Aboriginal people can only really be healed within finding their own identity once again. And as Christians as well, particularly, I think the Christian church has a vital role to play there. Small as it is, it can do it. But it's resources, it's vision, it's about people who, there are some of them around, who can actually make it happen. But essentially the government, the Commonwealth government, has the real whip hand when it comes to changing things. Some of you might have heard, when I was out there too, there was a big gathering at Broome of all the different tribes. Another meeting with the government. Lots of, you know, hand twisting and things, but it didn't actually make any progress either. There are lots of things happening. For instance, you know that in our next year, at least Uluru, which is a very sacred place for Aboriginal who live there, is now, you will not be able to walk up it anymore from August next year. One indication that they are being listened to. They are being given. Before, the government state would say, sorry, mate, you know, you can climb that place because you can climb that place, you know. And now more and more of the original Aboriginal people are actually getting themselves heard and things about significant things to their culture and their identity are being heard and things are changing slowly. But it is a long, long process. This is the key bit here. One of my conclusions is the Australian church, as fragmented as it is, it's only going to make things better if it can come together in some way. How that will happen, I don't know. Because I did say to the Bishop Greg, you know, it's amazing. Here he is, the bishop. He's so plugged into Aboriginal life. He knows what's going on down there. And even with his own kind of churchmanship issues, the kind of challenges they face there are just so, so big. And the diocese he's got is so, so small. I mean, you saw all the clergy there for a start. They don't have resources. There's no lots of money. A lot of the churches are financially really in the red because of the child abuse scandals and all the money going down there. Real, real challenges. But it was a privilege. And I have to say to everyone here and to the church, a privilege to be able to go away and to spend time living with another part of the church, because they are Anglicans like all of us. We are bound together in Anglicanism. And to share time, it was a privilege to share, even though it was depressing in times, also a lot of joy, a lot of wonderful activities I was shared in, and learning to love people, you know, in all corners of the diocese was just absolutely wonderful. God is faithful. That's what the strap line I put up there, because I think that is something that they certainly hold dear to, despite the problems. God is faithful to them and to us. And I feel bound or bonded with them in some way now, because having lived there with them, spent time with them, understood a little bit of their plight. Yeah, we feel that, yeah, in a kind of way, I'm sort of one of their champions, if you like, even over here. Where a solution will come from, we're not sure. But God is faithful in the midst of all their troubles. And we hope and pray that they will find their way out of a very dark place, the Aboriginal people particularly, and that the Church of Australia might somehow find a way to resource that sort of journey that they need to go on to. So, 3, well, past half 3. We said an hour and a half. Any questions? Now, Q&A, if you can, are you happy to stay for a little bit longer for questions?
Can I say just one thing you didn't mention?
Oh, they were.
And the white schools tried to, well, I don't say knock out, but educate all their traditions, their language, everything.
Well, that came out of that whole thing of assimilation. They said, we'll take those children and we'll civilize them in a kind of way by having them placed with. And so that whole generation now want to re-engage with their families that they were taken from. And there's a lot of anguish about, well, in fact, there was a formal apology made last year by the Prime Minister on behalf of the state to all those who were taken. I mean, that was one symptom of, I mean, there were lots of things going on where Aboriginal people were treated, you know, in a subhuman kind of way. I mean, can you imagine just forcibly taking children? I mean, a lot of children were hidden, they had to be taken. I mean, there was almost a terror of the state on some of those, because it was believed, and they would say in the best of intentions, we're going to take these kids from their mums and dads and civilize them and make them like us. And that's what they did. And lots of children today, the fallout of that is still very, very much with us. But there were many other things like that, you know, the, where Aberdeen Hill just faced a kind of, well, I mean, I still think today when I was out there, Australia is quite a racist society, sadly to say, but it is very much like that. I think partly because a lot of people, it was a bit like South Africa with the apartheid. When you separate people off from each other and you don't meet socially or any other way, if you separate them out, as apartheid did, you build in superstition, you build in a kind of fear factor, them and us. And a lot of Australians, certainly in Darwin, met some of them, who have never really met an Aboriginal man or woman, or had a conversation, or understood a little bit of where they're coming from. I even found that in New Zealand, this so-called wonderful land of the great long white cloud, I met some people in churches in Auckland. Same thing. I talked to them about the Waitangi Treaty. They had never heard of it. I said to them, well, do you realize, you know, what the relationship is between, you know, the Maoris here? Haven't got a clue. All they were complaining about was that this sort of compensating the tribes for lands, which were taken, you know, unjustly. You know, ignorance and superstition and fear and just plain, you know, racist views were certainly in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, still all there, built upon when you separate people out. If more Aboriginal people could connect and engage with more white people, make all the difference. But that's a long way off yet, I think, too. Any questions? Any other questions? I mean, this is a queue. Yes? They have a vote like any other. They are citizens now, so they do have a vote, but they're 2% of the population. So they vote. They don't have any. In New Zealand, they have the government, they have legislated a special voter registration list for Maoris, which gives them more impact and influence in the parliament. In Australia, there is no such thing. Basically, within the states, they have very little. Because the numbers, very little influence at all. And hence, they just disappear, effectively. Any other questions from anyone about that? I hope it's been helpful. It's been giving a good idea what I was up to. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Do the different sections of the church, the Roman Catholics, the Lutherans, have any connection
together? Now, you'd think in these days of, well, we're post-ecumenical almost nowadays, you'd think there would be some connection. As far as I could tell, no. In the city of Darwin, I mean, all the churches are in the city of Darwin, and my impression was, like the cathedral where I was based for 3 months, there was no connection with any other church, Roman Catholic or otherwise particular. Everyone was doing that. Even though in the city, all the churches are there. But when you head out the countries, for instance, the Tiwi Islands, for instance, the Tiwi Islands are the two big islands just off the coast of Darwin, two huge bits of land. And that's Roman Catholic. And I had people who were staying with in Perth later on, they had a relation who lived there, an Aboriginal man, who was one of those who went into a family because her father was the governor of Tasmania, and they did what government, but they took a young Aboriginal man into their family. He lives in the, and I tried to track him down, but I couldn't go to the Tiwi Islands without permission. As an Anglican person doing something like that, would have to get some permission to do it. Yeah, as an Anglican doing something with a Roman Catholic person, that is a bit odd. And it's just one of those legacies of the missionary periods where things were separated out. And it's rather sad. You're right. You think the ecumenical world, I wasn't aware of it being as something really important, particularly to the people there. I mean, the parishes, I went to preach and do services all around the churches in Darwin and on the outskirts as well. And they all are white, sadly. I thought I might find some Aboriginal people within the congregations there. And it reminded me a bit of South Africa, you know. I don't think it's intentionally like that. But the socioeconomic factors that are at play there mean that, you know, they don't feel comfortable. I was told in one of the churches there was actually someone who was from an Aboriginal background, but I never ever met them at the church when I went there. But I'd say as a rule, it's very, very a white man city, a white fella place. And then you go to the remote communities, very much, I was the only white face in the whole place. You know, very few white people there. And that's the sadness of the separation, you know, of how things work there. It doesn't mean there's going to be any kind of feeling of closeness when it comes to Christian sort of work. But a lot of missionaries still go there. When I was staying with the bishop for a bit, he had some missionaries staying upstairs in his house, and they were going to Gumbalanya to go and minister and to live in the community there, him, his wife, and family, four young kids, which was really courageous of them. But once again, it smacked to me of an old model of missionary work, of putting a family in the midst of an Aboriginal community and say, well, they're going to be a kind of a yeast that's going to do something wonderful. You know, the tragedy is they should be putting some Aboriginal missionaries in there and finding a way of working with them that's more authentically Aboriginal, but isn't happening. So this is the kind of the challenge that they face. And that isn't because of the dearth of people in college, as I was saying, in the theological college they've got there. They just weren't enough people of other kind of caliber, sadly. And that's because of the history of the government policy and all the rest of it that's made for a community there. It's such a dearth of well-educated people in their 40s. Yeah, yeah, you're right. I mean, Ruth, they're not.
That would make more sense in their culture than trying to get them to.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is, the realities are. I mean, in Australia, if you want to sort these issues out, you've got to have people who are going to have to go and advocate in the highest parliaments, in as MPs, as people, to change things. But you're right. I mean, there is an oral tradition. They're not a literate society. They're not that kind of tradition. But if they want to get things, if they want to move things on, for instance, if they want to find their own voice within an Anglican kind of context, I mean, reading and writing is really a thing, you know, and being literate in terms of theology, to have leaders who will become bishops. I mean, there are no Aboriginal bishops that just don't exist, and they really need to, and you have an Aboriginal, he's going to have to. I mean, I found this when I stayed with a bishop, a Maori bishop, up in the Bay of Islands when I was in. He went to Oxford and got his degree, you know, and a Maori man. Nothing like that is happening, you know, amongst the Aboriginal communities that I could tell, and which I think, you know, is a tragedy. There should be, there must be people. But because of this, in the history, this kind of huge kind of failure of government policy, and to some extent with the church as well, playing along with that, there is this dearth of leadership. Because I do need people who can advocate at the highest levels, who will have impact, you know, who will lead this community into something fresh and new. As I was saying, the kind of mode of working there is still fairly old-fashioned, sadly. And that needs to find new people. But I mean, you know, you're right. I mean, they have their own traditions. But I think for the church, for the Christians there in those remote communities, to have the permission and the ability to develop their own liturgy. I mean, talk about language. When I was out there, the Creole Bible was the only Bible translated. The irony is, CMS, who worked as missionaries for many, many years, the 60s and the 70s, were not encouraged to do translation work. Not encouraged at all. When I left there, they were just inaugurating the Goodwinkle Bible that had just been published, the second one. There are umpteen languages out there, and the people at the service, in fact, at the 50th anniversary, you saw all pictures of that, the 50th anniversary, that's when the Bible was presented to the priest, the parish priest of Numbulwahre, where they speak Goodwinkle. And the people were in tears to hear the scriptures read in their own language. Never happened before. Isn't it incredible? You think today, 2018, that would have been done years ago, but it wasn't. And the translation work is a vital part of what's still to be done there. But yeah, it's a combination of things, Ruth. I think, you know, you to make impact in Australia, when you've got a government that doesn't want to listen to anything anyway, you need people who are going to have some power and force up there. And you need to make those allies. And it means working the system. The political system, and you've got a good government. I think in Northern Territory are very sympathetic. You need people who are going to stand up then. And they used to have people like that. There were some people who were very powerful advocates, but they've all died off. And there is this real, that I could tell, a big gap in the leadership there, sadly. Right, everyone, I don't want to take any more questions because it's all recorded before. We want to make our way home. Anything else? I hope it's been insightful, hopefully giving you an idea what I was up to. Good, all right? Yeah, good. All right. Thank you to you all for making it possible, because I couldn't go without people like James and others filling in the gaps and doing things when in my absence. So great. And thank you for coming. Good.
Thank you.
All right. And I've got some things over here. If you want to look at some, I've got some little materials here. For those who do craft, they actually make their own. The ladies at the college at Langalinga make bags like this. And maybe the craft group can make bags like this. I don't know. I'm very impressed. Yeah. No more suggestions.